Hello, welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM with me, Sean Delaney. You can listen to or download hundreds of podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education at seandelaney.com/podcasts. A guest who appeared on Inside Education before is the philosopher and retired primary teacher, John Doyle. John is someone who throughout his career always tried to translate his philosophy of education into his classroom practice. And in turn, his classroom practice informed his philosophy of education. John was known by his students as a captivating storyteller. But on today's programme, he turns his attention to another teaching approach that he used a lot, questioning. Now, John has spoken on the programme before about how he sees the classroom as being a boxing ring, and the preparation a teacher does before stepping into the boxing ring is mind gym. John refers to the mind gym during today's programme. But he begins by reading an excerpt from an essay he wrote about the role of questioning in teaching.
Questions are never-ending. Questions have an order. Education helps us to expand our questions. Education helps us to set our questions in order. Everything may arouse questions. We may not always pursue our questions, but it's good to become aware of how we order questions. The best way to become aware of such order is to question something persistently. We could answer these unfolding questions. Children could work upon short swathes of such questions, seeking answers. Some answers could be discovered and others invented. Description could become story. Story could become drama. But you, the teacher, will ask your own questions and only implicitly answer them. Explicit answers are not the purpose of this challenge. We're searching for the hidden order of questions themselves. We are searching for how way leads on to way. We are working out in our mind gym. Children do not have to know. People once spoke of a great chain of being. Here we speak of a great chain of questions. Perhaps these questions open out a world in space and time. Perhaps they even open out our own world. Our world is suspended in a fabric of questions. Questions asked and questions answered, often by others long dead. We are creatures who ask questions. We can ask one question too many and watch a world collapse. Questions can lead us to see everything differently. Here we attempt to unfold the power of questions. Perhaps you would order them differently and demand answers. So we are choosing something. We call it the island. The island. Here come the questions. How did it get there? What is its underwater base like? What kind of rock is it made of? How deep is the water offshore? Does it have beaches? What color is the sand? Why is it that color? Is there somewhere to land? Is there a source of water? What is the source? Are there different zones where things are different? When does it rain? How heavily or how lightly does it rain? Does it snow? Does it freeze? At what time of year? For how long? Does the snow ever melt entirely? Or does it form a cap of ice? Are there even glaciers? Do they calve icebergs? Is the atmosphere dry or humid? Is it much colder at night? Is the island flat or does it have hills? Is there a range of mountains? Is there a place on the island from which the whole island can be seen? Does this offer a bird's eye view, or is the island only revealed to an eye from the sea? Is the island big or small? Compared with what? Is it wide at some points and narrow at others? Is the island a volcano? Is the volcano dead, dormant, or active? Is there any sign of lava flows? Is there any sign of rock folding? Are there layers of different kinds of rock exposed? Or is it all volcanic? Or is there no sign of a volcano? How then did the island form? Is the island isolated, or is it part of a chain of islands? Is it part of an archipelago of islands? What are the soils like? Is there any soil at all? Is it fertile or is the island barren? Is it hostile or hospitable to plant life? Is it treeless or forested? How much diversity in plant life is there? What difference does the wind make? Is there a growing season? What areas of the island encourage plant life? How did plants reach it? Are there any native plants? Are any edible? Is there any bird life on the island? Is there much bird song? At what time of year? Do birds visit en route to elsewhere? Or are there native birds? What do they look like? What do they sound like? Are there any flightless birds? Are there any native animals? What are they like? How did they arrive on the island? Is there predator and prey? Or did they die out? Or were they never there? Or is the island too far from everywhere for mammals to reach it? Are there many insects? Are there many flies? Are there more at certain times or seasons? Are there any snakes? Is there anything poisonous on the island? Now, I could go on. I have many, many, many more questions. But I'm saying, to me, what we do in class is we put the world under pressure, under the pressure of questioning, and we keep it that way. And the world yields. It yields itself up. There is revelation beyond revelation beyond revelation. Our questions are answered. Sometimes the answers are not what we expected, but we keep up the pressure of questions. So I don't know how many questions I have here, maybe 1,000, but this is from the Mind Gym, and it's just an exemplar of how we go about things. We go about things in many ways. For example, if we're making music, it's not the same as persistent questioning. So I think teachers ask questions, children ask questions, books ask questions. But, you know, there's such a thing as a passion for questioning, where actually questioning outruns everything. There is runaway questioning, but above all, there's an order in questioning. Now, each one of these questions that I have read out could be answered. In fact, I'd say if you gave each child a few questions and said, now they're your questions now, see, can you answer them? But they say, what is the island? Which island are we talking about? And I'd say, well, now this is interesting. There are many, many islands. There are thousands of islands. Find your island, but ask these questions and give them answers. So in a way, you might say, there's another thing, searching for your island. Let me take you to the island. To me, the island is, it's almost a final fantasy. There's nowhere to go. You reach the island and you are home. So it's a long, long trek of questions. And these questions I have here, they would last a year. They might even last 2 years. But it's not so much these questions or those questions or the other questions. It's the intensity and persistence of questioning that actually awakens the world. And when the world wakes up, you wake up with it and you will never go to sleep again.
Do the questions come from you or do they come from the children?
These questions all come from me working outside the classroom in the Mind Gym. Of course, questions arise in class, but I actually expose the children, as it were, to a blizzard of questions. And it can be catching in the sense that they know that I value questions. The only thing I ask is persistency. If you ask me this question, well, what now would be the next question and the next? Questions have an order. You slowly are led deeply into things. When they discover that, they know what to do. And I'm saying, just think of Socrates. Socrates is the moment of questioning. And there has never been an end to questions since. But there could be. There could be a culture that is complacent, a culture that becomes effete, that actually becomes ultimately stagnant, where people feel there are no good questions worth asking. We know, they become knowing. Questions fall away. Well, that's kind of final stagnancy, terminal stagnancy. As a teacher, you know, I have heroes. Children have heroes, maybe comic book heroes. But I have heroes, and Socrates is one. Socrates is a hero. And when I read Socrates, that is through Plato's dialogues, I'm always startled, really startled. In fact, I can never get over it. The way his questions unfold. No hurry, not polemical, very respectful, but very penetrating, And in the end, they leave you no place to hide. Socrates made many men angry. And in some cases, he made the wrong men angry because they thought they knew more than they did. And there's something intrinsically awesome and shocking about watching someone who seems to know begin to retreat, initially maybe in good order, but then panic and turn his back to the enemy and run. Socrates would not run after anyone, nor would he cast a weapon after them. But it happened all too often, and eventually these people wanted their revenge. That's another story. Anyway, Socrates, a hero of questioning, the great exemplar of questioning, how to question, in what order to question, that is Socrates, especially as presented in the dialogues of Plato. Yes, that's part of the mind gym. Go to the source and learn from the master. There are many masters.
Where does the impetus for questioning come from? Or what is the source of curiosity? In other words, you know, you talked about the danger of becoming too knowing. So how do we avoid that happening? By acknowledging or appreciating the source of curiosity.
Aristotle begins a book of his called A Metaphysics by saying boldly, all men desire to know. And he doesn't go behind that. He goes from that. So they want to know what. And then his book is, this is what they really desire to know. And he explores it. I think Aristotle is right about children. They really desire to know. Think of very young children who keep asking questions. I might be sitting in the bus. There might be a mother there with a child. And the questions about every little detail of things going on. And the mother patiently answering them. I just say, this is nature. This is the nature of the kind of thing we are. We are questioning. And questioning goes with quest. We're on a quest. And the ultimate question is, you know, who am I? What am I? How did I get here? Where am I going? You might even ask the question, do I have a mission? A mission to do? Mission impossible? I've never met a child who had no questions. A child without questions is a child who, in my view, has learned fear. Fear can make you mute. But if you can forget your fear, the sun will come out and questions will come out. And then the teacher has to be ready for these questions and actually show children these are good questions and there are ways of answering them, not just one way, many ways. And those many ways have to be in touch with the classroom. Now, right now, classrooms have whiteboards, these electronic whiteboards, which allow you to draw from the internet. Wow. This is where the teacher has to take responsibility, deep responsibility. And in the gym, the teacher explores many of these things and is ready to introduce them at the right moment, in the right way, in the right situation, in class. There's a moment of joy. It is a moment of joy that a question you ask, you feel is now going to be answered. And it may be answered in perhaps even in image or even a video. There's a whole world of responsibilities here, which a teacher must tread carefully. And the best way to do that is the teacher is a scout. The teacher is a pioneer. The teacher goes ahead. The teacher knows the forest. That brings you back to the mind gym. The teacher cannot neglect the mind gym. Because if they do neglect it, little by little, they can fall back. They fall back upon the books, the textbooks, and they have little more to say. That will not arouse in children persistent questioning. So there are many things to be said, but I say, if there's persistent questioning, there's a world. No questions, no world.
So does persistent questioning trump the quality of questions? In other words, do you believe that there's no such thing as a stupid question or no such thing as a bad question? Or are some questions inherently more productive than others?
Well, when children question, one thing that I've always been interested in is putting their questions in order, accepting their questions. This is what it's all about. I'm not actually grudgingly accepting their questions. I seize upon their questions. Their questions to me are like slingshots, which can really reach far, far into the world. So I will never neglect a slingshot. After all, it was a slingshot that brought down Goliath. So questions to me, they're like arrows. And then you have to bend the bow. Are you strong enough to bend the bow and make that arrow fly far and accurately? There are many things in play with a question. So, of course, I accept all questions, but not all questions are equal. In some cases, you have to answer this question before you can answer that question. And a lot of my teaching, actually, children often said to me, how is it we started here and we ended up there? And I said, I have no idea. It happens all the time. And part of it is backing up. You get a question. In order to answer that question, you have to step back and answer a logically or historically prior question, which in turn calls for an answering of an even more prior question. And that happens all the time in my class, all the time. They're used to it. They're used to me. But at the same time, they know that questions are, for me, action. This is where things are going to happen, a question. We're going to pursue it. We're not going to let it go. We'll pursue it. And you'll find a question is a part of a constellation of questions. It's not just one question, a lonely question, as it were. Questions are built on questions. And sometimes the children have answered those questions, and that's why they raise this next question. But sometimes I would take a question, and they ask that question of something. And I, yes, try and answer it. But then I use that question again, something else and something else, that this is a good question to ask because it turns a key and something opens and something is revealed. So in a way, I want the children to develop their own quiver full of questions. That takes time. Remember, in primary school, you're not just dealing with one year. Children go on to other years. So it all unfolds and it's all vital and it's all active action. So it's bigger than fun. It's just bigger.
Where then did an expression like curiosity kill the cat? What kind of thinking lay behind that?
I've heard it said, you know, information makes him fat. Curiosity killed the cat. Information made him fat. Well, the connection between those two sentences might be that if you answer a cat's questions, the cat really wants to know, where is lunch? So, no, cats are very curious, but they have their, let's say, avenues of curiosity. And outside those avenues, they are not curious. This is a mysterious thing, you know. Dogs are curious, but outside a certain range, they're not curious. We are curious, but our range can keep developing. It's our mind multiplies itself in many directions. We feed on questions. Questions nourish us. Now, there is a problem which I identify as one question too many. And you discover something prematurely, or maybe something that you're better off not knowing. There are some people who think that knowing is good, knowing more is better, knowing everything is best. That would certainly be true if the world wasn't full of wickedness and deception. In other words, in this world, there is a place for courage. There will never be a need for no courage. No courage leads to complacency. And what people are complacent about, they will lose. They will lose it. That applies on many levels. Neglecting something, you will lose it. So courage is important. Then the question is, can you have enough courage? Then the question is, do you have allies who have courage? A small platoon, as it were, your buddies. In other words, is courage scarce? Is courage appreciated? Is courage cultivated? There are whole cultures who do not think they need courage, because they have not been challenged, perhaps in their generation or even in the previous generation. I say they're in great danger of succumbing to complacency, and complacency can go towards a kind of vacuity where the door swings open. So there's part of education there, you know, not questioning. Courage. It takes courage to ask a question. It might take courage to accept the answer. It might take wisdom to know when to stop questioning. I think it might take a lot of wisdom to know when enough is enough. But all that is something that has to be communicated. And, you know, because we're in time, you know, a school day is a day. You can curve it so that kind of there's an intensity of questioning. But the teacher can actually, through bringing other things into play, make sure that no one asks that one question too many. Or if they do, the teacher will have a way of kicking for touch. In other words, you cannot know everything immediately, on demand. It's going to cost you. It's going to cost you patience. There's a long march here. So in a way, what you're doing is you're getting children used to the long march. But they're not in the French Foreign Legion, as it were, marching in the desert, in the heat, savage heat of the desert. In ways, they're sheltered, cloistered. I see a class, I've compared it to many things, and it is many things. Simultaneously, can it be a boxing ring and a cloister? The answer is, of course it can. It depends on how you're seeing it. And I think one of the most important things about a classroom is that it is a cloister. It's a bubble of protection. And the children are free to ask the kind of questions for which there really is little place outside. Above all, it's the ordered questioning, the making questioning fruitful over time. That's what is possible in the classroom. Ordered questioning. So when a child asks a question, of course it's acceptable, but I always love showing them that that question presupposes the answer to another question, which presupposes the answer to an earlier question, and get used to the order of questions. It comes into view slowly and it goes out of view. It's beyond me. I could spend not a day in a class or a week or a month or a term or a year. Many years, in fact, a life, asking questions and pondering the order of questions. The order of questions. That is worth exploring with children. What questions are more important than others? You know, when I was young, this is a long time ago, there was a program on radio called 20 Questions. I think it's the first time in my life that I paid any attention to questions and the power of questions. It's as if someone, I don't know, I can't remember now. It's as if someone had a card and on the card was written something. It could be, I don't know, anything, an orange. So there was a panel of three people and they had to find out what was on that card by asking questions. And they were allowed 20 questions. Not 25 or 30. So the questions had to be telling. In other words, what questions would you ask first? And the first question always was, I remember chanting, animal, vegetable or mineral. And then it would narrow down after that. In a way, I think, if you ask me, why did I write this thing about the island? I think that's why I wrote it. Because very early on, maybe in the 1950s on radio, I was listening to this program and learning from these people asking their questions. Now, it was meant to be serious, but it was also meant to be fun. In other words, an enjoyable program, entertainment. But nevertheless, what got through to me was, if you ask the right questions in the right order and you persist, something will be revealed. So in a way, that's my attitude with the children. If they ask me a question, would I answer it? Maybe not. Maybe I'd say, there's a really good question. What brought you to ask that question? I said, I don't want that question. I want a cluster of questions around that question. And then I'll answer them all. By the way, now you've heard the question, all of you, talk to the child beside you. Find another question that's in the zone with those questions. And then everyone will tell their question. I'd say, now let's begin. And let's put these questions into some kind of order. Which one do we have to answer first so that we can answer in the second, third? That would be a lesson or two or three. The basic point I'm making, I suppose, is anything can go anywhere.
You've kind of touched on this already, John, but I wonder, can you say another little bit about what the teacher's role is in the questioning? Or more particularly, what I'm wondering about is, what implications would this kind of approach to teaching, where you're trying to get questions from the children, what kind of implications does that have for the preparation of teachers, or for how teachers can prepare themselves for teaching?
Since we're talking about questions, I would say whatever teachers do in colleges of education, whatever they do, I think they should do something about questions. They should raise questions. They should address something, X, Y, Z, and address as many questions to that as possible, but in order. Now, the questions I have addressed to the island, they are in order. Like, this is just the final writing something down. But When I began to think about this, I would have worked out, as it were, on the island 100 times before I would write this down. And which island? Many islands. After all, Ireland is an island. But I would go to tropical islands and Arctic islands, islands in lakes. Ah. Islands are just amazing for the imagination. So much of my questioning was addressed to them, but my questions were all over the place. But little by little, I tried to put them into order so that no matter what island I would meet, this would be like 20 questions, which I experienced as a boy. What questions would I really want to ask? For example, is there water on this island? I really want to know, because you could find a beautiful tropical island and no water. Anyway, there are many questions, and that question, is there water? You could make a drama straight away. You're arriving on the island. We're home, find water, and coming back. No water here, no water there. There's no water, and there's no other island. There's something, I don't know how it's ending, but maybe we have to repair this little boat. It's leaky, it's holed below the waterline. We pulled it up on the beach, but if we go into the water again, it's going to last, and so on and so on. You can see that, for me anyway, every question is a potential drama. And when I say drama, I don't really mean a little bit of theatrics. This could be destiny. This could be the difference between death and life. So if you were in my class, you would find that there are a number of things going on simultaneously, that I get distracted. The drama thing might emerge suddenly. I wouldn't say, oh, now it's time to do drama. Never. Just do drama right there as it comes up. And then go on. The quest. I'm conscious that I'm not really answering your questions. When you ask a question, it's as if I call up many classes, many classrooms, many groups of children, and many workouts in the mind gym, which always leads me to the bigger world. And the bigger world is always casting its light into the classroom.
And that reflection on questions in the classroom and the place of the classroom in the bigger world came from retired primary school teacher and philosopher John Doyle. Feel free to join the conversation on the podcast's website, insideed.com, or on Twitter at insideed. That's all we have time for this week. Remember, you can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on seandelaney.com or on iTunes. My own book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, which is published by Routledge, is available now online from the Routledge website, or from any online bookseller, or on request from your local library. You can email me at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.